reminiscing. I feel you near. Once more, you're my love of yesteryear.
The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, my name is Jim Butts from the Triangle, North Carolina Reading Service now, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading from the Reminisce magazine. Starting out today was a story that's sent in by Ron Weiss of Highland Falls, New York. He writes, on TV with Joe DiMaggio. On October 5th, 1942, I was invited to appear as a guest on a TV show hosted by Joe DiMaggio, one of my baseball heroes. The program called The Bottini Show was sponsored by that big pasta company. I was one of three baseball selected to go on the show. We were all 14 and students at the American Baseball Academy, which was free to boys 13 through 18. Who were interested in baseball and lived in New York City. The Academy was founded by Phil Rizzuto, the Yankees shortstop and a professional baseball player taught there as well. That week's show had a guest appearance by Rizzuto, who was the maestro of bunting in the American League. On the show, he was going to teach the three of us the art of bunting. I remember that DiMaggio was dressed impeccably in a blue pinstripe suit, with his gray hair shining in the bright set lights. We were supposed to answer baseball trivia questions, and the winner would be awarded a Bulova watch. The runner-up would win a year's supply of the Bottini spaghetti. I made it to the final question, which was, who pitched the most scoreless innings in the World Series? Anybody know that? Okay, here we go. He writes, I knew the correct answer was Babe Ruth, but I thought about the prizes and asked myself, what would I rather win? The answer was easy, so I said, Whitey Ford. To a 14-year-old, when time seemed endless, spaghetti for a year was better than a watch. I'm sure I looked more happy than sad when Joe said, sorry, Ron. You win a year's supply of spaghetti. For the next year, a delivery of Bottini's pasta arrived at our apartment each month, right on schedule. To this day, my twin daughters, Serena and Vinica, and I eat a serving of Bottini at least once a week, prepared by Patricia, my wife of 44 years. Thanks to Ron from Highland Falls, New York, for that story. Just a sidebar here about Joe DiMaggio. Joe was born Giuseppe Paolo DiMaggio Jr., November 25, 1914, in Martinez, California. He died March 8, 1999, in Hollywood, Florida. He was an outfielder for the New York Yankees from 1936 to 1951. He took time off from the game to serve with the Army 1943 to 45. He stayed stateside, but his service lifted morale for the military and the nation. The song Joltin' Joe DiMaggio marked his 56-game hitting streak, a record which still stands. There is always some kid who may be seeing me for the first time or last time. I owe him my best, said Joe. And those of us who remember Joe's his love for Marilyn Monroe, as you recall, he put a rose out every day, I think, at her grave. So, interesting story about Joe DiMaggio. Here's one from on Spotlight from the magazine, front and center, Hattie McDaniel. This was sent in by, goodness, wonder if this was sent in by Hattie. I don't see the author's name listed on this particular show, but here we go. Talk about Hattie. Hattie McDaniel was a veteran of the stage and radio and a powerful singer who wrote her own songs. She shifted into movies in the early 1930s and eventually got the role of Mammy in Gone with the Wind in 1939, amid tough competition. At the 1940 Academy Awards, McDaniel made history when she became the first African-American to win an Oscar, taking supporting actress in a field that included her co-star, Olivia de Havilland. Here are a few more essential facts about McDaniel. She was the youngest of 13 children. She was born in 1893, some sources say 1895, in Wichita, Kansas, to Henry and Susan McDaniel, former slaves, and grew up in Denver, Colorado. Her father fought in the Civil War. Most of the family enjoyed performing. Hattie quit high school in 1910 to join her brother's minstrel and carnival show. She worked as a bathroom attendant to make ends meet. While touring work dried up in 1929, McDaniel took a job as a bathroom attendant at a club in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. She soon sang her way into a regular performing gig. She was friends with Clark Gable. Excuse me. The two became close during the filming of China Seas in 1935. With she and Clark Gable being friends, when he learned the Gone with the Wind premiere would be at a whites-only theater in Georgia, barring McDaniel, Gable refused to go. McDaniel persuaded him to change his mind. She appeared in more than 300 movies. McDaniel also was the first African-American to headline a radio series, The Beulah Show. She took over the role from a white male actor who impersonated an African-American woman. Her Oscar is missing. McDaniel willed her Academy Award to Howard University, and it disappeared in the early 1970s. In 2011, historian W. Burnett Carter tried to trace it and concluded it is in deep in storage somewhere. The Oscar is an odd shape. It's a plaque, not a statuette, but which means it may not be recognized for what it is. So, interesting story about Hattie McDaniel, who we will probably remember as Mammy in Gone with the Wind. Anyway, okay, from our live section, Growing Up, Wait Your Turn is the title of the story by Judy Sikorsky of Rossford, Ohio. My brother Fred was 18 months older than me. Whatever interested him interested me too. He didn't like it, but our parents insisted that he share his toys with me. I loved playing with his Lionel train set and building windmills and skyscrapers with his Egretker set. But the sharing role was different for comic books. There was an unwritten law that whoever had the comic books was allowed to keep them until they finished reading what they chose. We always had a big tug-of-war over Batman and Superman. Luckily, sharing was not an issue when it came to my favorites, like Little Lulu or Little Lotta, which Fred didn't like to read. And he wouldn't touch Katie Keene, which often came with paper dolls to cut out. Fred would make a stack of his favorites and read them one by one, casting them aside as he finished. I waited patiently, sometimes, until he finished reading the whole pile, and then they were mine. I'm convinced he tried to get away with reading as slowly as possible. I've kept some of the Katie Keene comics, and they bring back memories of hours of quiet enjoyment that I didn't have to share with my big brother. Written by Judy Sikorsky of Rossford, Ohio. How about anybody else have an overdue library book, an overdue library card? Well, here's a story by Joan Wester Anderson of Wheeling, Illinois. She writes, "Angels don't always wear wings, as I discovered when I was 5 and had just learned to read. Every day I had 20 precious minutes at the Rogers Park Public Library in Chicago to pore over the saga of Dick and Jane before my mother returned from grocery shopping on Clark Street. I love the new children's librarian, Mrs. Fettergreen, who often suggested books I might like. One day she asked why I never checked out anything. You could take some books home and spend more time reading, she pointed out. I would like that, I answered, but I don't have a library card. The lady in charge of handing out library cards had already told me that I had to be able to write my name in order to get a card. How I hated to admit I could only print. Miss Fettergren loved books and wanted her young patrons to love them too, without encountering unnecessary barriers. Now, she was truly miffed. I thought I heard a sigh as she grasped my hand and swept us both down a book-lined aisle. That is a situation that we're going to fix right now. Adult voices murmured and rose behind a large desk as librarians conferred. Then, in a moment of magic, I was given my card to fill out. My childish printing almost covered the application, but I had the gateway to the world. How Miss Fettergren, the newbie, was able to cut through the red tape, I never found out. But shortly thereafter, the library's rule about writing was eliminated. My library card angel gave me, and every child who entered that heavenly place, the gifts of knowledge, wonder, and imagination. Good on you, Miss Fettergren. That was a good deal. Okay, you might need a tissue on this story. This is from Our Lives, Our Heroes. There's a picture here of two guys who are in uniform. Looks like they're in World War II, and they're both kind of huddled up together, and they both have an arm wrapped around a dog. It's kind of a, can't tell the exact color, but looks like maybe black and brown and white or something. So Joanne M. Wolinsky of 40 Fort, Pennsylvania, wrote in here. She writes, one of four brothers who served their country during the war, my father, John W. Wolinsky, remembers watching the Boston shoreline vanish as she left aboard the USS Wakefield July 25, 1944, en route to Liverpool in England. He was 23, leaving behind his bride of 8 months. The thought of never seeing that shoreline again haunted him as the waterfront disappeared from sight. He was assigned to the Army's 551st Engineer Heavy Pontoon Battalion, where he earned the rank of line corporal. His job was to assemble pontoon bridges, heavy-duty structures, that supported the movement of massive tanks. During the construction of the bridges, machines shot out clouds of white smoke to conceal the men from the most enemy fire. One cold September morning, while Dad's battalion was constructed yet another viaduct over the Moselle River, Moselle River in France, the deadly German 88 set aim and fired steadily on the working area, which offered no cover. The company sergeant, in trying to stir morale, was hit and suffered the loss of both legs. Many other soldiers were wounded or killed. Amid the slaughter and the deafening barrage, my dad saw a shivering brown and white dog. In spite of the horror around them, the soldiers of Company B rescued the terrified animal, taking him back to camp where he became known as 88. The men of Company B fed, watered, petted, and played with 88. Caring for the dog was a comforting reminder of life and boyhood when the world felt safe. When the war ended, my dad returned home and mainstreamed back into civilian life. He took advantage of the GI Bill to attend carpentry school, which led to his involvement in the housing boom of the post-war years. I'm grateful for my dad and others who came back and helped to make America into a safe place for their sons and daughters, and where dogs like 88 could be pets. Okay, let's do a love story now. How about this? True love. This is by Lynn Stater of Westford, Massachusetts. This love story begins during a 1970s winter in one of those Midwestern towns outlined in cornfields. After graduating from Bowling Green State University, I was teaching sixth grade in White House, Ohio. My music major helped me get a second job as a choir director at the Methodist Church there. At a church supper one evening, I noticed a handsome sailor. He wore the latest wire-rimmed glasses, a trendy contrast to his military haircut and fatigues. His name was Terry, and he had deployed twice to Vietnam. He told me he was stationed on the USS Gridley in San Diego and was home to visit his family. Terry didn't stay long, but as he left, he looked back across the room at me. G.I. Joe meets John Lennon, I thought. After choir practice that same evening, his mother, Pat, approached saying she hoped I'd like to go out with Terry, who really liked redheads. I gave a polite excuse because I was already dating someone. 2 days later, a Friday, Terry invited me on a double date with his sister and her fiancé. Terry called the next morning and offered to shovel me out of some overnight snow and spent the day driving me on my errands. I felt like I'd known him forever. He left only when my friends, including my boyfriend, were scheduled to come over. On Sunday, Terry and I were on the way to a family event when I asked him to pull the car over. I was about to tell him I was going to break up with my boyfriend when he spoke up, "I think I'm going to marry you." Without thinking, I replied, "If you ask me, I'll say yes." With a marriage proposal made and accepted 2 days after our first date, I soon had to introduce Terry to my family. When I introduced him to my cousins Fern and Bob Wilt, I forgot his name. Fortunately, Terry saw the humor in this, and everyone else assumed I was overwhelmed by the new engagement ring on my finger. I really didn't know how my parents got any sleep after that. We had a long-distance engagement for about 6 months, then a June wedding in Toledo, Ohio. We spent 3 years in San Diego with the Navy before moving with our daughter, Emily, first to the Midwest and later to Westford, where Terry was a veteran service officer and I taught at the public schools. Now retired, Terry and I have a trip planned to San Diego to visit our granddaughter, who serves in the Navy there. This is by Lynn Statter of Westford, Massachusetts. Good story. John Benz of Highlands Ranch, Colorado, he said in this story, he's got a picture to go with this of the downtown area back in the days, because the story takes place from 1955 to 57. But you look at the picture and you can see that it looks like what is the main street of town here. And prominently in the picture is the place he's going to talk about where he worked, L. Weeman Company, 5 and 5 cent to a dollar store. And if you look down the street in this picture, their cars, probably in the most of them look like they're in early 1950s, some 1940s car. And back in those days when people drove to town and did all their shopping and parked along by the sidewalk there on the street. And on the bridge, there's a bridge in the left corner of the picture here. And there's just two guys. One's kind of leaning on the bridge, and they're just kind of passing the time of day, looks like, talking about what's going on, I suppose, in the world. But I digress here. Let's go on to John's story. He writes, "From 1955 to 57, I worked every day after school and all day Saturdays at Women's Dime Store. My manager, Max Schuplis, was aware child labor laws didn't allow me to work that much, but he also knew how important the job was to me financially and personally, so he let me continue. From my perspective, it wasn't really work because I enjoyed it so much. Weeman's is a local Milwaukee, Wisconsin competitor to Woolworth. I started in the stockroom, moving stuff, breaking up boxes, and cleaning the store. When they hired another stock boy, I moved to the sales floor, where I was the only male. Then Max started grooming me for a career in merchandising. He taught me how to lay out counters, trim windows, price items, and deal with customers. He knew it all. Max was eventually moved to a different store that needed his expertise, and the founder's nephew, Hugh, got Max's old job. Hugh spent most of the day standing at one end of the aisle with a clipboard. I have no idea what was on that clipboard, but it couldn't have been very important because he hardly ever looked at it. Most of my friends and 90% of my self-worth came from that job. My high school yearbook included a brief description of the graduates' activities over the years. Some of my classmates had a list a mile long, and even the students who didn't care about school had at least been in the boys' club. My listing was simply John Benz. When I graduated, I moved on to another job that paid more. The move turned out to be a good one because Weemans eventually succumbed to World War's size and power and sadly exists no more. To the guys who were my football heroes in high school, my job must have been pretty tame stuff. But I remember my days in retail very fondly. Good story about growing up and working hard there. Here's a story about the clipboard. I think one of my kids one time said, I got a job, but I need to, you know, look like I'm always doing something highly professional. I said, well, just get a clipboard and walk around and make notes. And he later told me, he said, that wasn't a bad idea. Checking our ancestry and our roots seems to be a popular thing these days, and sometimes you get some surprises, and other times you can't find all the information. So this is by Dennis Graybowl of Grafton, Wisconsin. Researching my family, I found many oddities and a few outright mysteries. Frederick and Sophie Graybowl came to the U.S. around 1866. Frederick's citizenship papers show he was born in Mecklenburg, Schwerin, Germany. My grandfather, George, always claimed Frederick's son, and George's father, Otto, was born in Spain. I checked U.S. Census records and found that those from 1900 and 1920 did indeed list Spain as Otto's birthplace, as George claimed. But in 1880, census gave Otto's birthplace as Central America, and the one from 1870 said Venezuela, and Otto's citizenship papers state he was born in Central America. Why did all these records differ? A partial answer to the mystery came from a book about the founding of my hometown, Waukesha, Wisconsin. It includes an account from Otto's sister, Sophia Graybowl, who said that while the family was traveling to America from Germany, their ship was blown off course by a hurricane. The storm damaged the ship and forcing the passengers to land in Venezuela, where they were stranded for 13 years. Sophia and Otto were born there. I have no clue why some of the census's record Otto's birthplace as Spain. When answering the census, did my family say Otto was Spanish because Venezuela was a Spanish-speaking country? I've decided it's a mystery. Some going off track here on this story, some important strategies for research are mentioned in Otto's story, the very things we need to focus on. Our ancestors were on the move a lot. A move may have involved crossing a continent or ocean. Things could happen that redirected their course. When we analyze the research, it may differ from what we find in an online tree. Back up your findings with documentation, with vital records, Bible entries, baptism and christening records, census records, probate records, migration patterns. Since sources provide proof that an event took place, but not the context. For example, a family migrating from New England to Ohio in the early 1800s may have traveled on the Erie Canal. Along the way, they may have recorded a life event that occurred in a small New York town, even though they never settled there. Iris Ross of Salina, Ohio, has a story here about a trip of a lifetime. Of the many birthdays I've had in my life, 88 to be exact, one stands far and above the rest. This special birthday was May 1949, the year I graduated from high school in New Madison. Our school had 19 graduates that year, and we all went on a class trip to Detroit, Michigan. From there, we were to travel by overnight cruise ship to Niagara Falls. For a small group of students from a rural school, it was the greatest adventure of any of us could imagine. We had two drivers who took us to Detroit, student Wilson Bunger and our senior advisor, Mr. Windrick. On board, we were two to a cabin. After settling in, we explored, wandering all over the ship. I'll never forget the name, the SS Neuronic of Port Arthur, Ontario, a luxury liner known as the Queen of the Great Lakes. The Neuronic could accommodate over 500 passengers. The first night out, we had dinner and a dance. At one point during the festivities, it was announced that a student was celebrating a birthday. I heard my name called out, and I was asked to come forward. Then all of the passengers and the crew sang, "Happy Birthday to Me." That moment is etched in my memory. Our trip to visit the falls was magical. We saw the rapids, walked along the International Bridge, and then had a lunch in the city before returning to Detroit the following day. I have never forgotten that birthday. By 2019, when we would have celebrated our 70th reunion, only a few classmates were living. There is a tragic postscript to the story of the Neuronic. In the early hours of September 17, 1949, 4 months after our trip, the ship caught fire while docked in Toronto, Ontario, with many lives lost. Learning about the Neuronic's unfortunate fate makes my memory of her when she was a host of one of the happiest days of my life all the more precious. Bill Weber of Tucson, Arizona writes, "Our farm near Holstein, Iowa, was about 6 miles from town. I attended high school in the late 1940s and early 50s, and the only transportation there and back was a school bus. I really wanted to play sports, football, track, and basketball, which were held after school. Of course, if I rode the school bus, there was no way I could do sports. In the 1940s, my parents had very little money to spend on things like transportation for me. My dad told me I was going to have to find my own way home if I wanted to be in sports. I decided that I would make some money. I took jobs helping neighbors so I could buy something to ride. I chose a Whizzer motorbike. The Gamble store in Holstein sold them for around $175. I made enough money to buy a bike, and one of my friends got one too. I rode the bike to school every day, even in winter. Once it snowed so much, I had to leave the bike at school and catch a ride home. I graduated in 1952 and had that reliable way up until I had to give it up. Time to go now. We've run out of time. Be sure to tune in next time. I'm Jim Butts. Hope you've enjoyed it for the North Carolina Radio Reading Service.